Sir Walter Pole to Jonathan Strange, Harley Street, London, October 1st, 1816. A bookseller in St. Paul's Churchyard, Titus Watkins, has printed up a very nonsensical book and is selling it as Strange's Lost History and Practice of English Magic. Lord Portishead says some of it is copied out of Absalom. Footnote 1. The Tree of Learning by Gregory Absalom, 1507-99. And some of it is nonsense. Portishead wonders which you will find the most insulting, the Absalom part or the nonsense. Like a good fellow, Portishead contradicts this imposition wherever he goes, but a great many people have already been taken in, and Watkins has certainly made money. I'm glad that you like Miss Gracedieu so much. Jonathan Strange to John Murray. Campo Santa Maria Subenigo, Venice, November 16th, 1816. My dear Murray, you will be pleased, I think, to hear that some good, at least, has come from the destruction of the history and practice of English magic. I have made up my quarrel with Lord Byron. His lordship knows nothing of the great controversies which are rending English magic in two, and frankly cares less. But he has the greatest respect for books. He informs me that he is constantly on guard lest your overcautious pen, Mr. Murray, should alter some of his own poems and render some of the more surprising words a little more respectable. When he heard that a whole book had been magicked out of existence by the author's enemy, his indignation was scarcely to be described. He sent me a long letter vilifying Norrell in the liveliest terms. Of all the letters I received upon that sad occasion, this is my favourite. No Englishman alive can equal his lordship for an insult. He arrived in Venice about a week ago, and we met at Florian's. Footnote 2. A famous café on the San Marco Piazza. I confess to being a little anxious, lest he should bring that insolent young person, Mrs. Claremont. But happily, she was nowhere to be seen. Apparently he dismissed her some time ago. Our new friendly relations have been sealed by the discovery that we share a fondness for billiards. I play when I'm thinking about magic, and he plays when he's hatching his poems. The sunlight was as cold and clear as the note struck by a knife on a fine wine glass. In such a light, the walls of the churches of Santa Maria Formosa were as white as shells or bones, and the shadows on the paving stones were as blue as the sea. The door to the church opened, and a little party came out into the campo. These ladies and gentlemen were visitors to the city of Venice who had been looking at the interior of the church, its altars and objects of interest, and now that they had got out of it, they were inclined to be talkative and filled up the water-lapped silence of the place with loud, cheerful conversation. They were excessively pleased with the Campo Santa Maria Formosa. They thought the facades of the houses very magnificent. They could not praise them highly enough. But the sad decay which buildings, bridges, and church all displayed seemed to charm them even more. They were Englishmen, and to them the decline of other nations was the most natural thing in the world. They belonged to a race blessed with so sensitive an appreciation of its own talents, and so doubtful an opinion of anybody else's, that they would not have been at all surprised to learn that the Venetians themselves had been entirely ignorant of the merits of their own city, until Englishmen had come to tell them it was delightful. One lady, having got to the end of her raptures, began to speak of the weather to the other lady.
"You know, it is a very odd thing, my dear, but when we were in the church, while you and Mr. Strange were looking at the pictures, I just popped my head out of the door, and I thought then that it was raining, and I was very much afraid that you would get wet."
No, Aunt. See, the stones are perfectly dry. There's not a spot of rain upon them."
"Well, then, my dear, I hope that you're not inconvenienced by this wind. It is a little sharp about the ears. Though we can always ask Mr. Strange and Papa to walk a little faster, if you do not like it."
"Thank you, Aunt, but I am perfectly comfortable. I like this breeze. I like the smell of the sea. It clears the brain, the senses, everything. But perhaps, Aunt, you do not like it."
"Oh, no, my dear. I never mind any such thing. I'm quite hardy. I only think of you."
"I know you do, Aunt," said the young lady. The young lady was perhaps aware that the sunlight and breeze which showed Venice to so much advantage, made its canals so blue and its marble so mystically bright, did as much, or almost as much, for her. Nothing could so well draw attention to the translucency of Miss Graysteel's complexion as the rapid progression across it of sunlight and shadow. Nothing could be so becoming to her white muslin gown as the breeze which blew it about.
Ah, said the aunt. Now Papa is showing Mr. Strange some new thing or other. Flora, my dear, would not you like to see?
I have seen enough.
You go, aunt.
So the aunt hurried away to the other end of the campo, and Miss Greysteel walked slowly on to the little white bridge that stood just by the church, fretfully poking the point of her white parasol between the white paving stones, and murmuring to herself, I have seen enough. Oh, I have seen quite enough. The repetition of this mysterious exclamation did not appear to afford her spirits much relief. Indeed, it only served to make her more melancholy, and to make her sigh more frequently.
You're very quiet today, said Strange suddenly.
She was startled. She had not known he was so close by.
Am I? I was not aware of it.
But she then gave her attention to the view, and was silent for several moments. Strange leant back against the bridge, folded his arms, and looked very intently at her.
Quiet, he repeated, and a little sad, I think. And so, you know, I must talk to you.
This made her smile in spite of herself.
Must you? She said.
But then the very act of smiling and of speaking to him seemed to give her pain, and so she sighed and looked away again.
Indeed. Because whenever I am melancholy, you talk to me of cheerful things and cure my low spirits, and so I must now do the same for you. That is what friendship is.
Openness and honesty, Mr. Strange. Those are the best foundations for friendship, I think.
Oh, you think me secretive? I see by your face that you do.
You may be right, but I... Well, that is...
No, I dare say you are right.
It is not, I suppose, a profession that encourages... Miss Greysteel interrupted him.
I did not mean a fling at your profession. Not at all. All professions have their different sorts of discretion. That, I think, is quite understood.
Then I do not understand you.
It is no matter. We should rejoin my aunt and papa.
No, wait, Miss Greysteel. It will not do. Who else will put me right when I am going wrong, if not you? Tell me. Whom do you think I deceive?
Miss Greysteel was silent a moment, and then, with some reluctance, said,
Your friend of last night, perhaps.
My friend of last night? What do you mean?
Miss Greysteel looked very unhappy.
The young woman in the gondola, who was so anxious to speak to you, and so unwilling for a full half hour, that anyone else should.
Ah. Strange smiled and shook his head. No, you've run away with the wrong idea. She is not my friend. She is Lord Byron's.
Oh.
Miss Greysteel reddened a little.
She seemed rather an agitated young person.
She's not best pleased with his lordship's behavior.
Strange shrugged.
Who is?
She wished to discover if I were able to influence his lordship, and I was at some pains to persuade her that there is not now, nor ever was, I think, magic enough in England to do that.
You are offended?
Not in the least. Now I believe we are closer to that good understanding which you require for friendship. Will you shake hands with me?
With the greatest goodwill, she said.
Laura! Mr. Strange!
Cried Dr. Greysteel, striding up to them.
What is this?
Miss Greysteel was a little confused. It was of the greatest importance to her that her aunt and father should have a good opinion of Mr. Strange. She did not want them to know that she herself had suspected him of wrongdoing. She feigned not to have heard her father's question, and began to speak energetically of some paintings in the Scuola di Giorgio degli Schiavoni that she had a great desire to see.
It is really no distance. We could go now. You will come with us, I hope, she said to Strange.
Strange smiled ruefully at her. I have work to do.
Your book? Asked Dr. Greysteel.
Not today. I'm working to uncover the magic which will bring forth a fairy spirit to be my assistant. I've lost count of how many times I've tried, and how many ways, and never, of course, with the least success. But such is the predicament of the modern magician. Spells which were once taken for granted by every minor sorcerer in England are now so elusive that we despair of ever getting them back. A Martin Pale had 28 fairy servants.
I would count myself fortunate to have one.
Fairies? Exclaimed Aunt Greysteel. But by all accounts, they're very mischievous creatures. Are you quite certain, Mr. Strange, that you really wish to burden yourself with such a troublesome companion?
My dear aunt, said Miss Greysteel, Mr. Strange knows what he's doing.
But Aunt Greysteel was concerned, and to illustrate her point, she began to speak of a river that flowed through the village in Derbyshire, where she and Dr. Greysteel had grown up. It had been enchanted by fairies long ago, and as a consequence had shrunk from a noble torrent to a gentle brook. And though this had happened centuries and centuries ago, the local population still remembered and resented it. They still talked of the workshops they might have set up and the industries that they might have founded if only the river had been strong enough to supply the power.
Footnote 3.
Aunt Greysteel is probably speaking of the Derwent. Long ago, when John Usglass was still a captive child in Faerie, a king in Faerie foretold that if he came to adulthood, then all the old fairy kingdoms would fall. The king sent his servants into England to bring back an iron knife to kill him. The knife was forged by a blacksmith on the banks of the Derwent, and the waters of the Derwent were used to cool the hot metal. However, the attempt to kill John Usglass failed, and the king and his clan were destroyed by the boy magician. When John Usglass entered England and established his kingdom, his fairy followers went in search of the blacksmith. They killed him and his family, destroyed his house, and laid magic spells upon the Derwent to punish it for its part in making the wicked knife. Strange listened politely, and when she had finished, he said, "Oh, to be sure, fairies are naturally full of wickedness and exceedingly difficult to control. Were I successful, I should certainly have to take care whom my fairy or fairies associated with." He cast a glance at Miss Greysteel. Nevertheless, their power and knowledge are such that a magician cannot lightly dispense with their help, not unless he's Gilbert Narl. Every fairy that ever drew breath has more magic in his head, hands, and heart than could be contained in the greatest library of magical books that ever existed. Footnote 4. The views Strange is expressing at this point are wildly optimistic and romantic. English magical literature is full of examples of fairies whose powers were weak or who were stupid or ignorant.
Has he indeed? Said Aunt Greysteel. Well, that is remarkable.
Dr. Greysteel and Aunt Greysteel wished Strange success with his magic, and Miss Greysteel reminded him that he had promised to go with her one day soon to look at a pianoforte, which they had heard was for hire from an antiquarian who lived near the Campo San Angelo. Then the Greysteels went on to the rest of the day's pleasures, while Strange returned to his lodgings near Santa Maria's Abenego. Most English gentlemen who come to Italy nowadays write poems or descriptions of their tour, or they make sketches. Italians who wish to rent apartments to these gentlemen are well advised to provide them with rooms where they can pursue these occupations. A Strange's landlord, for example, had set aside a shadowy little chamber at the top of his house for his tenants' use. It contained an ancient table with four carved griffins to serve for its legs. There was a sea captain's chair, a painted wooden cupboard such as one might find in a church, and a wooden figure 2 or 3 feet tall which stood upon a pillar. It represented a smiling man holding something round and red in his hand, which might have been an apple, might have been a pomegranate, or might have been a red ball. It was difficult to imagine quite where this gentleman could have come from. He was a little too cheerful for a saint in a church, and not quite comical enough for a coffee-house sign. Strange had found the cupboard to be damp and full of mildew, and so he had abandoned it and placed his books and papers in heaps about the floor. But he had made a sort of friend of the wooden figure, and as he worked, he constantly addressed remarks to it, such as, "What is your opinion?" and, "Doncaster or Bellasis, what do you suggest?"
Footnote 5.
Jacques Bellasis was reputed to have created an excellent spell for summoning fairy spirits. Unfortunately, the only copy of Bellasis's masterpiece, The Instructions, was at the library at Hertview, and Strange had never seen it. All he knew of it were vague descriptions in later histories, and so it must be assumed that Strange was recreating this magic, and had only the flimsiest notion of what he was aiming at. By contrast, the spell commonly attributed to the Master of Doncaster is very well known, and appears in a number of widely available works. The identity of the Master of Doncaster is not known.
His existence is deduced from a handful of references in Argentine histories to 13th-century magicians acquiring spells and magic from Doncaster. Moreover, it is far from clear that all the magic attributed to the Master of Doncaster is the work of one man. This has led magio historians to postulate a second magician, even more shadowy than the first, the pseudo-master of Doncaster. If, as has been convincingly argued, the Master of Doncaster was really John Usglass, then it is logical to assume that the spell of summoning was created by the pseudo-master. It seems highly unlikely that John Usglass would have had any need of a spell to summon fairies. His court was, after all, full of them. And, well, do you see him? I do not. And once, in tones of extreme exasperation, "Oh, be quiet, will you?" He took out a paper on which he had scribbled a spell. He moved his lips, as magicians do when they're reciting magic words. When he had finished, he glanced about the room as though he half expected to find another person there. But whomever it was that he hoped to see, he did not see them. He sighed, crumpled the spell into a ball, and threw it at the little wooden figure. Then he took another sheet of paper, made some notes, consulted a book, retrieved the first piece of paper from the floor, smoothed it out, studied it for half an hour, pulling at his hair all the while, crumpled it up again, and threw it out the window. A bell had begun to toll somewhere. It was a sad and lonely sound, which made the hearer think of wild, forlorn places, dark skies and emptiness. Some of these ideas must have occurred to Strange, because he became distracted and stopped what he was doing and glanced out of the window as though to reassure himself that Venice had not suddenly become an empty, silent ruin. But the scene outside was the usual one of bustle and animation. Sunlight shone on blue water, the campo was crowded with people, there were Venetian ladies coming to Santa Maria Zobenigo. Austrian soldiers strolling about arm in arm and looking at everything, shopkeepers trying to sell them things, urchins fighting and begging cats going about their secret business. Strange returned to his work. He took off his coat and rolled up the sleeve of his shirt. Next, he left the room and returned with a knife and a small white basin. He used the knife to let some blood from his arm. He put the basin on the table and peered into it to see if he had got enough. But the loss of blood must have affected him more than he supposed, because in a moment of faintness, he knocked the table, and the bowl fell upon the floor. He cursed in Italian, a good cursing language, and looked around for something to wipe up the blood. It so happened that there was some white cloth lying bundled up on top of the table. It was a nightshirt, which Arabella had sewn in the early years of their marriage. Without realizing what it was, Strange reached out for it. He had almost grasped it, when Stephen Black stepped out of the shadows and handed him a rag. Stephen accompanied the action with that faint half-bow that is second nature to a well-trained servant. Strange took the rag and mopped up the blood somewhat ineffectually, but of Stephen's presence in the room he appeared to know nothing at all. Stephen picked up the nightshirt, shook out the creases, carefully folded it up, and placed it neatly on a stool in the corner. Strange threw himself back into his chair, caught the damaged part of his arm upon the edge of the table, swore again, and covered his face with his hands. "What in the world is he trying to do?" asked Stephen Black in a hushed tone. "Oh, he is attempting to summon me," declared the gentleman with the thistledown hair. "He wishes to ask me all sorts of questions about magic. But there is no need to whisper, my dear Stephen. He can neither see nor hear you. They're so ridiculous, these English magicians. They do everything in such a roundabout way. I tell you, Stephen, watching this fellow try to do magic is like watching a man sit down to eat his dinner with his coat on backwards, a blindfold around his eyes, and a bucket over his head. When did you ever see me perform such nonsensical tricks? Draw forth my own blood or scribble words on paper? Whenever I wish to do something, I simply speak to the air or to the stones or to the sunlight, or the sea, or to whatever it is, and politely request them to help me. And then, since my alliances with these powerful spirits were set in place thousands of years ago, they are only too glad to do whatever I ask."
"I see," said Stephen. "But though the magician is ignorant, he has still succeeded. After all, you are here, sir, are you not?"
Yes, I dare say.
said the gentleman in irritated tone. "But that does not detract from the fact that the magic that brought me here is clumsy and inelegant. Besides, what does it profit him? Nothing. I do not choose to show myself to him, and he knows no magic to counteract that. Stephen, quick, turn the pages of that book. There is no breeze in the room, and it will perplex him beyond anything. See how he stares. He half suspects that we're here, but he cannot see us. How angry he is becoming. Give his neck a sharp pinch. He'll think it's a mosquito.
Chapter 52. The Old Lady of Cannareggio. End of November, 1816. Sometime before he had left England, Dr. Greysteel had received a letter from a friend in Scotland, begging that if he were ever to get as far as Venice, he would pay a visit to a certain old lady who lived there. It would be, said the Scottish friend, an act of charity, since this old lady, once rich, was now poor. Dr. Greysteel thought he remembered hearing once that she was of some odd mixed parentage, as it might be half Scottish, half Spanish, or perhaps half Irish, half Hebrew. Dr. Greysteel had always intended to visit her, but what with inns and carriages, sudden removals and changes of plan, he had discovered on arriving at Venice that he could no longer lay his hand on the letter, and no longer retained a very clear impression of its contents. Nor had he any note of her name, nothing but a little scrap of paper with the direction where she might be found. Aunt Greysteel said that under such very difficult circumstances as these, they would do best to send the old lady a letter informing her of their intention to call upon her. Though, to be sure, she added, it would look very odd that they did not know her name. Doubtless she would think them a sad, negligent sort of people. Dr. Greysteel looked uncomfortable and sniffed and fidgeted a good deal, but he could think of no better plan, and so they wrote the note forthwith and gave it to their landlady, so that she might deliver it to the old lady straight away. Then came the first odd part of business. The landlady studied the direction, frowned, and then, for reasons which Dr. Greysteel did not entirely comprehend, sent it to her brother-in-law on the island of Giudecca. Some days later, this same brother-in-law, an elegant little Venetian lawyer, waited upon Dr. Greysteel. He informed Dr. Greysteel that he had sent the note, just as Dr. Greysteel had requested, but Dr. Greysteel should know that the lady lived in that part of the city which was called Cannareggio, in the ghetto, where the Jews lived. The letter had been delivered into the hands of a venerable Hebrew gentleman. There had been no reply. How did Dr. Greysteel wish to proceed? The little Venetian lawyer was happy to serve Dr. Greysteel in any way he could. In the late afternoon, Miss Greysteel, Aunt Greysteel, Dr. Greysteel, and the lawyer, whose name was Signor Tossetti, glided through the city in a gondola, through that part of the city which is called St. Mark's, where they saw men and women preparing for the night's pleasures, past the landing of Santa Maria Zobenigo, where Miss Greysteel turned back to gaze at a little candlelit window, which might have belonged to Jonathan Strange, past the Rialto, where Aunt Greysteel began to tut and sigh and wish very much that she saw more shoes upon the children's feet. They left the gondola at the Ghetto Nuovo. Though all the houses of Venice are strange and old, those of the ghetto seemed particularly so, as if queerness and ancientness were two of the commodities this mercantile people dealt in, and they had constructed their houses out of them. Though all the streets of Venice are melancholy, these streets had a melancholy that was quite distinct, as if Jewish sadness and Gentile sadness were made up according to different recipes. Yet the houses were very plain, and the door upon which Signor Tossetti knocked was black enough and humble enough to have done for any Quaker meeting house in England. The door was opened by a manservant who let them into the house, and into a dark chamber panelled with dried-out, ancient-looking wood that smelt of nothing so much as the sea. There was a door in this chamber that was open a little. From where he stood, Dr. Greysteel could see ancient, battered-looking books in thin leather bindings, silver candlesticks that had sprouted more branches than English candlesticks generally do, mysterious-looking boxes of polished wood, all of which Dr. Greysteel took to be connected with the Hebrew gentleman's religion. Hung upon the wall was a doll or puppet as tall and broad as a man, with huge hands and feet, but dressed like a woman, with its head sunk upon its breast so that its face could not be seen.
The manservant went through this door to speak to his master.
Dr. Greysteel whispered to his sister that the servant was decent-looking enough.
Yes, said Aunt Greysteel, except that he wore no coat.
Aunt Greysteel said that she had often noticed that male servants were always liable to present themselves in their shirt-sleeves, that it was often the case that if their masters were single gentlemen, then nothing would be done to correct this bad habit. Aunt Greysteel did not know why this should be. Aunt Greysteel supposed that the Hebrew gentleman was a widower.
Oh, said Dr. Greysteel, peeping through the half-open doorway. We have interrupted him at his dinner.
The venerable Hebrew gentleman wore a long, dusty black coat, and had a great beard of curly grey and white hairs, and a black skull-cap on top of his head. He was seated at a long table, upon which was laid a spotless white linen cloth, and he had tucked a generous portion of this into the neck of his black robe to serve him as a napkin. Aunt Greysteel was very shocked that Dr. Greysteel should be spying through chinks in doorways, and attempted to make him stop by poking at him with her umbrella. But Dr. Greysteel had come to Italy to see everything he could, and saw no reason to make an exception of Hebrew gentlemen in their private apartments. This particular Hebrew gentleman did not seem inclined to interrupt his dinner to wait upon an unknown English family. He appeared to be instructing the manservant in what to say to them. The servant came back and spoke to Signor Tosetti, and when he had finished, Signor Tosetti bowed low to Aunt Greysteel and explained that the name of the lady they sought was Delgado, and that she lived at the very top of the house. Signor Tosetti was a little annoyed that none of the Hebrew gentleman's servants seemed willing to show them the way and announce their arrival. But as he said, their party was one of bold adventurers, and doubtless they could find their way to the top of a staircase. Dr. Greysteel and Signor Tosetti took a candle each. The staircase wound up into the shadows. They passed many doors, which, although rather grand, had a queer, stunted look about them. For in order to accommodate all the people, the houses in the ghetto had been built as tall and with as many stories as the householders had dared, and to compensate for this, all the ceilings were rather low. At first, they heard people talking behind these doors, and at one they heard a man singing a sad song in an unknown language. Then they came to doors that stood open, showing only darkness. A cold, stale draught came from each. The last door, however, was closed. They knocked, but no one answered. They called out they were come to wait upon Mrs. Delgado. Still no reply. And then, because Aunt Greysteel said that it was foolish to come so far and just go away again, they pushed open the door and went inside. The room, which was scarcely more than an attic, had all the wretchedness that old age and extreme poverty could give it. It contained nothing that was not broken, chipped, or ragged. Every colour in the room had faded, or darkened, or done what it must until it was grey. There was one little window that was open to the evening air and showed the moon, although it was a little surprising that the moon with her clean white face and fingers should condescend to make an appearance in that dirty little room. Yet this was not what made Dr. Greysteel look so alarmed, made him pull at his neckcloth, redden and go pale alternately, and draw great breaths of air. If there was one thing which Dr. Greysteel disliked more than another, it was cats, and the room was full of cats. In the midst of the cats sat a very thin person on a dusty wooden chair. It was lucky, as Signor Tosetti had said, that the Greysteels were all bold adventurers, for the sight of Mrs. Delgado might well have been a little shocking to nervous persons, for though she sat very upright, one would almost have said that she was poised, waiting for something. She bore so many of the signs and disfigurings of extreme old age that she was losing her resemblance to other human beings and began instead to resemble other orders of living creatures. Her arms lay in her lap, so extravagantly spotted with brown that they were like two fish. Her skin was the white, almost transparent skin of the extremely old, as fine and wrinkled as a spider's web, with veins of knotted blue. She did not rise at their entrance, nor make any sign that she had noticed them at all. But perhaps she did not hear them, for though the room was silent, the silence of half a hundred cats is a peculiar thing, like 50 individual silences all piled one on top of another. So the Greysteels and Signor Tosetti, practical people, sat down in the terrible little room, And Aunt Greysteel, with her kind smile and solicitous wishes that everyone should be made comfortable and easy, began their addresses to the old lady.
I hope, my dear Mrs. Delgado, that you will forgive this intrusion, but my niece and I wish to do ourselves the honor of waiting upon you.
Aunt Greysteel paused in case the old lady wished to make a reply, but the old lady said nothing.
What an airy situation you have here, ma'am. A dear friend of mine, a Miss Wildsmith, lodges in a little room at the top of a house in Queen Square in Bath, a room much like your own, Mrs. Delgado, and she declares that in summer she would not exchange it for the best house in the city, for she catches the breezes that nobody else gets, and is perfectly cool when great people stifle in their rich apartments, and she has everything so neat and tidy and just to hand whenever she wants it. And her only complaint is that the girl from the second back pair is always putting hot kettles on the staircase, which, as you know, Mrs. Delgado, can be so very displeasing if you chance to strike your foot against one of them. Do you suffer much inconvenience from the staircase, ma'am?
There was a silence, or rather some moments passed filled with nothing but the breathing of 50 cats. Dr. Greysteel dabbed at his sweating brow with his handkerchief and shifted about inside his clothes.
Well, we're here, ma'am, he began, at the particular request of Mr. John McKean of Aberdeenshire. He wishes to be remembered to you. He hopes that you are well and sends every good wish for your future health.
Dr. Greysteel spoke rather louder than usual, for he had begun to suspect that the old lady was deaf. This had no other effect, however, than to disturb the cats, many of which began to stalk around the room, brushing against each other and sending up sparks into the twilight air. A black cat dropped from somewhere or other onto the back of Dr. Greysteel's chair and walked it as if it were a tightrope. Dr. Greysteel took a moment to recover himself, and then said,
"May we take back some report of your health and situation to Mr. McKean, ma'am?"
But the old lady said nothing. Miss Greysteel was next.
"I'm glad, ma'am," she said, "to see you so well provided with good friends. They must be a great comfort to you. That little honey-coloured puss at your feet, what an elegant form she has, and such a dainty way of washing her face. What do you call her?"
But the old lady did not answer. So, prompted by a glance from Dr. Greysteel, the little Venetian lawyer began to relate much of what had already been said, but this time in Italian. The only difference was that now the old lady no longer troubled to look at them, but fixed her gaze upon a great grey cat, which was in turn looking at a white cat, which was in its turn staring at the moon.
"Tell her that I've brought her money," said Dr. Greysteel to the lawyer. "Tell her it is a gift made to her on behalf of John McKean. Tell her she must not thank me."
Dr. Greysteel waved his hand vigorously, as if a reputation for generous deeds and benevolent actions were a little like a mosquito, and he hoped in this way to prevent one from landing on him.
"Mr. Tossetti," said Aunt Greysteel, "you're not well. You're pale, sir. Will you have a glass of water? I'm sure that Mrs. Delgado could furnish you with a glass of water."
"No, Madamina Greysteel, I am not ill. I am..."
Signor Tossetti looked around the room to find the word he wanted.
"Fearful," he whispered.
"Fearful?" whispered Dr. Greysteel.
"Why? What of?"
"Ah, Signor Dottore, this is a terrible place,"
returned the other in a whisper, and his eyes wandered in a kind of horror, first to where one of the cats was licking its paw, in preparation to washing its face, and then back to the old lady, as if in expectation of seeing her perform the same action. Miss Greysteel whispered that in their concern to show Mrs. Delgado attention, they had come in too great a number and arrived too suddenly at her door. Clearly, they were the first visitors she had had in years. Was it any wonder her wits seemed temporarily to be wandering? It was too severe a trial.
"Oh, Flora," whispered Aunt Greysteel, "only think, to pass years and years without society of any kind."
To be all whispering together in such a small room, for the old lady was not 3 feet distant from any of them, appeared to Dr. Greysteel to be very ridiculous, and from not knowing what else to do, he became rather irritable with his companions, so that his sister and daughter judged it best to go. Aunt Greysteel insisted on taking a long, fond farewell of the old lady, telling her that they would all return when she was feeling better, which Aunt Greysteel hoped would be soon. Just as they passed through the door, they looked back. At that moment, a new cat appeared upon the sill of the window with a stiff, spiky something in its mouth, a thing remarkably like a dead bird. The old lady made a little joyous sound and sprang with surprising energy out of her chair. It was the oddest sound in all the world, and bore not the slightest resemblance to human speech. It made Signor Tosetti, in his turn, cry out in alarm and pull the door shut, and hide whatever it was that the old lady was about to do next. Footnote 1. Signor Tosetti later confessed to the Greysteels that he believed he knew who the old lady of Canareggio was. He had heard her story often as he went about the city, but until he had seen her with his own eyes, he had dismissed it as a mere fable, a tale to frighten the young and foolish. It seems her father had been a Jew, and her mother was descended from half the races of Europe. As a child, she had learnt several languages, and spoke them all perfectly. There was nothing she could not make herself mistress of if she chose. She learned for the pleasure of it. At 16, she spoke not only French, Italian, and German, which are part of any lady's commonplace accomplishments, but all the languages of the civilized and uncivilized world. She spoke the language of the Scottish Highlands, which is like singing. She spoke Basque, which is a language which rarely makes any impression upon the brains of any other race, so that a man may hear it as often and as long as he likes, but never afterwards be able to recall a single syllable of it. She even learnt the language of a strange country, which Signor Tosetti had been told some people believed still existed, although no one in the world could say where it was. The name of this country was Wales. She travelled through the world and appeared before kings and queens, archdukes and archduchesses, princes and bishops, grafs and graffins, and to each and every one of these important people she spoke in the language he or she had learnt as a child, and every one of them proclaimed her a wonder. And at last she came to Venice. But this lady had never learnt to moderate her behaviour in anything. Her appetite for learning was matched by her appetite in other things, and she had married a man who was the same. This lady and her husband came at Carnevali and never went away again. All their wealth they gambled away in the ridottos, all their health they lost in other pleasures. And one morning, when all of Venice's canals were silver and rose-colored with the dawn, the husband lay down upon the wet stones of the Fondamenta dei Mori and died, and there was nothing anyone could do to save him. And the wife would perhaps have done as well to do the same, for she had no money and nowhere to go. But the Jews remembered that she had some claim to their charity, being, in a manner of speaking, a Jewess herself, though she had never before acknowledged it. Or perhaps they felt for her as a suffering creature, but the Jews have endured much in Venice. However it was, they gave her shelter in the ghetto. There are different stories of what happened next, but what they all agree upon is that she lived among the Jews, but she was not one of them. She lived quite alone, and whether the fault was hers or whether the fault was theirs, I do not know. And a great deal of time went by, and she did not speak to a living soul, and a great wind of madness howled through her and overturned all her languages. And she forgot Italian, forgot English, forgot Latin, forgot Basque, forgot Welsh, forgot everything in the world except cat. And that, it is said, she spoke marvellously well. Chapter 53. A Little Dead Grey Mouse. End of November, 1816. The following evening, in a room where Venetian gloom and Venetian magnificence mingled in a highly romantic and satisfactory manner, the Greysteels and Strange sat down to dinner together. The floor was of cracked, worn marble, all the colours of a Venetian winter. Aunt Greysteel's head, in its neat white cap, was set off by the vast dark door that loomed in the distance behind her. The door was surmounted by dim carvings, and resembled nothing so much as some funerary monument wreathed in dreary shadows. On the plaster walls were the ghosts of frescoes, painted in the ghosts of colours, all glorifying some ancient Venetian family, whose last heir had drowned long ago. The present owners were as poor as church mice, and had not been able to repair their house for many years. It was raining outside, and what was more surprising, inside too. From somewhere in the room came the disagreeable sound of large quantities of water dripping liberally upon floor and furniture. But the Greysteels were not to be made gloomy, nor put off a very good dinner by such trifles as these. They had banished the funereal shadows with a good blaze of candlelight, and were masking the sound of dripping water with laughter and conversation. They were, generally, bestowing a cheerful Englishness on that part of the room where they sat. "But I do not understand," said Strange. "Who takes care of the old woman?" Dr. Greysteel said,
"The Jewish gentleman, who seems a very charitable old person, provides her with a place to live, and his servants put dishes of food for her at the foot of the stairs."
"But as to how the food is conveyed to her," exclaimed Miss Greysteel, "no one knows for certain. The Signor Tassetti believes that her cats carry it up to her."
"Such nonsense," declared Dr. Greysteel. "Whoever heard of cats doing anything useful?"
"Except for staring at one in a supercilious manner," said Strange. "That has a sort of moral usefulness, I suppose, in making one feel uncomfortable and encouraging sober reflection upon one's imperfections." The Greysteels' odd adventure had supplied the subject of conversation since they had sat down to dinner.
"Flora, my dear," said Aunt Greysteel, "Mr. Strange will begin to think we cannot talk of anything else."
"Oh, do not trouble upon my account," said Strange. "It is curious, and we magicians collect curiosities, you know."
"Could you cure her by magic, Mr. Strange?" asked Miss Greysteel.
"Cure madness? No, though it is not for want of trying. I was once asked to visit a mad old gentleman to see what I could do for him, and I believe I cast stronger spells upon that occasion than upon any other. But at the end of my visit, he was just as mad as ever."
"But there might be recipes for curing madness, might there not?" asked Miss Greysteel eagerly. "I dare say the Orient magicians might have had one."
Miss Greysteel had begun to interest herself in magical history, and her conversation these days was full of words like Orient and Argentine. "Possibly," said Strange. "But if so, then the prescription has been lost for hundreds of years."
"And if it were 1,000 years, then I am sure that it need be no impediment to you. You have related to us dozens of examples of spells which were thought to be lost, and which you have been able to recover."
"True, but generally I had some idea of how to begin. I never heard of a single instance of an Orient magician curing madness. Their attitude towards madness seems to have been quite different from ours. They regarded madmen as seers and prophets, and listened to their ramblings with the closest attention."
"How strange. Why?"
"And Mr. Norrell believed it was something to do with the sympathy which fairies feel for madmen. That, and the fact that madmen can perceive fairy spirits when no one else can." Strange paused. "You say this old woman is very mad?" he said.
"Oh, yes, I believe so."
In the drawing room after dinner, Dr. Greysteel fell soundly asleep in his chair. Aunt Greysteel nodded in hers, waking every now and then to apologize for her sleepiness, and then promptly falling asleep again. So Miss Greysteel was able to enjoy a tete-a-tete with Strange for the rest of the evening. She had a great deal to say to him. On his recommendation, she had recently been reading Lord Portishead's A Child's History of the Raven King, and she wished to ask him about it. However, he seemed distracted, and several times she had the disagreeable impression that he was not attending to her. The following day, the Greysteels visited the arsenal, and were full of admiration for its gloom and vastness. They idled away an hour or two in curiosity shops, where the shopkeepers seemed nearly as quaint and old-fashioned as the curiosities themselves, and they ate ices at a pastry cook's near the church of San Stefano. To all the pleasures of the day, Strange had been invited, but early in the morning, Aunt Greysteel had received a short note presenting his compliments and thanks, but he had come quite by accident upon a new line of inquiry, and dare not leave it. "And scholars, madam, as you know by example of your own brother, are the most selfish beings in creation, and think that devotion to their researches excuses anything." Nor did he appear the next day, when they visited the Scuola di Santa Maria della Carita, nor the following one, when they went by gondola to Torcello, a lonely reed-choked island shrouded in grey mists, where the first Venetian city had been raised, been magnificent, been deserted, and finally crumbled away, all long, long ago. But though Strange was shut away in his rooms near Santa Maria's Obenigo, doing magic, Dr. Greysteel was spared the anguish of missing him greatly by the frequency with which his name was mentioned among them. If the Greysteels walked by the Rialto, and if the sight of that bridge drew Dr. Greysteel on to talk of Shylock, Shakespeare, and the condition of the modern theatre, then Dr. Greysteel was sure to have the benefit of strangers' opinions upon all these subjects, for Miss Greysteel knew them all, and could argue for them quite as well as for her own. If in a little curiosity shop the Greysteels were struck by a painting of a quaint dancing bear, then it only served as an opportunity for Miss Greysteel to tell her father of an acquaintance of Mr. Strange who had a stuffed brown bear in a glass case. If the Greysteels ate mutton, then Miss Greysteel was sure to be reminded of an occasion of which Mr. Strange had told her when he had eaten mutton at Lyme Regis. On the evening of the third day, Dr. Greysteel sent Strange a message proposing that the two of them should take a coffee and a glass of Italian spirit together. They met at Florian's a little after 6 o'clock.
"I'm glad to see you," said Dr. Greysteel. "But you look pale. Are you remembering to eat, to sleep, to take exercise?"
"I believe I ate something today," said Strange, "although I really cannot recall what it was."
They talked for a while of indifferent matters, but Strange was distracted. Several times he answered Dr. Greysteel almost at random. Then, swallowing the last of his grappa, he took out his pocket watch and said, "I hope you will forgive my hurrying away. I have an engagement. And so, good night." Dr. Greysteel was a little surprised at this, and could not help but wonder what sort of an engagement it might be. A man might behave badly anywhere in the world, but it seemed to Dr. Greysteel that in Venice he might behave worse, and do so more frequently. No other city in the world was so bent upon providing opportunities for every sort of mischief, and Dr. Greysteel happened to be particularly concerned at this period that Strange should have a character beyond reproach. So he inquired, with as careless an air as he could manage, whether the appointment was with Lord Byron. "No, indeed. To own the truth," Strange narrowed his eyes and grew confidential, "I believe I may have found someone to aid me."
"You're a fairy?"
"No, another human being. I have high hopes of this collaboration, yet at the same time I am not quite sure how the other person will greet my proposals. You will understand that under such circumstances, I have no desire to keep them waiting."
"Oh, no, indeed," exclaimed Dr. Greysteel. "Go, go."
Strange walked away, and became one of the many black figures on the piazza, all with black faces and no expressions, hurrying across the face of moon-colored Venice. The moon itself was set among great architectural clouds, so that there appeared to be another moonlit city in the sky, whose grandeur rivaled Venice, and whose great palaces and streets were crumbling and falling into ruins, as if some spirit in a whimsical mood had set it there to mock the others' slow decline. Meanwhile, Aunt Greysteel and Miss Greysteel had taken advantage of the doctor's absence to return to the terrible little room at the top of the house in the ghetto. They had come in secret, having an idea that Dr. Greysteel, and perhaps even Mr. Strange, might try to prevent them going, or else insist upon accompanying them, and they had no wish for male companionship upon this occasion.
"They will want to be talking about it," said Aunt Greysteel. "They'll be trying to guess how she came to this sad condition. But what good will that do? How does that help her?"
Miss Greysteel had brought some candles and a candlestick. She lit the candle so that they could see what they were doing. Then, out of their baskets, they took a nice savory dish of veal fricassee that filled the stale, desperate room with a good smell, some fresh white rolls, some apples, and a warm shawl. Aunt Greysteel placed the plate of veal fricassee before Mrs. Delgado, but she found that Mrs. Delgado's fingers and fingernails were as curved and stiff as claws, and she could not coax them round the handles of the knife and fork.
"Well, my dear," said Aunt Greysteel at last, "she shows great interest in it, and I'm sure it will do her good, but I think we'll leave her to eat it in whatever way she thinks best."
They went down into the street. As soon as they were outside, Aunt Greysteel exclaimed,
"Oh, Flora! Did you see? She had her supper already prepared. There was a little china saucer, quite a pretty saucer, rather like my tea service with rosebuds and forgive-me-nots. And she had laid a mouse in it. a little dead grey mouse.
Miss Greysteel looked thoughtful.
I dare say a head of chicory, boiled and dressed with a sauce as they prepare it here, looks a little like a mouse.
Oh, my dear, said Aunt Greysteel, you know it was nothing of the sort.
They were walking through the Ghetto Vecchio towards Cannaregio Canal when Miss Greysteel turned suddenly away into the shadows and disappeared from sight.
Plora, what is the matter? Cried Aunt Greysteel. What do you see? Do not linger, my love. It is so very dark here among the houses. Dearest, Flora!
Miss Greysteel moved back into the light as quickly as she'd gone away.
It's nothing, Aunt, she said. Don't be startled. It's only that I thought I heard someone say my name, and I went to see. I thought it was someone I knew, but there's no one there.
At the Fondamenta, their gondola was waiting for them. The oarsmen handed them in, and then, with slow strokes, moved away. Aunt Greysteel made herself snug under the covering in the centre of the boat. Rain began to patter upon the canvas.
Perhaps when we get home we shall find Mr. Strange with Papa, she said. Perhaps, said Miss Greysteel.
Or maybe he's gone to play billiards with Lord Byron again, said Aunt Greysteel. It's odd that they should be friends. They seem such very different gentlemen.
Oh, indeed. Though Mr. Strange told me that he found Lord Byron a great deal less agreeable when he met him in Switzerland. His lordship was with some other poetical people who claimed all his attention and whose company he clearly preferred to that of anyone else. Mr. Strange says that he was barely civil.
Well, that is very bad, but not at all surprising. Should not you be afraid to look at him, my love? Lord Byron, I mean, I think that perhaps I might, a little.
No, I should not be afraid.
Well, my love, that is because you are more clear-headed and steady than other people. Indeed, I do not know what there is in the world that you would be afraid of.
Oh, I do not think it is because of any extraordinary courage on my part. As to extraordinary virtue, I cannot tell. I was never yet much tempted to do anything very bad. It is only that Lord Byron could never have any power over me, or sway the least of my thoughts or actions. I am quite safe from him, but that is not to say that there might not be someone in the world, I do not say that I have seen him yet, whom I would be a little afraid to look at sometimes, for fear that he might be looking sad, or lost, or thoughtful, or, what you know, might seem worst of all, brooding on some private anger or hurt, and so not knowing or caring if I looked at him at all.
In the little attic at the top of the house in the ghetto, Miss Greysteel's candles guttered and went out. The moon shone down into the nightmare apartment, and the old lady of Cannaregio began to devour the veal fricassee which the Greysteel ladies had brought her. She was about to swallow the last bite, when an English voice suddenly said, "Unfortunately, my friends did not stay to perform the introductions, and it is always an awkward business, is it not, madam, when two people are left together in a room to get acquainted? My name is Strange. Yours, madam, though you do not know it, is Delgado, and I am delighted to meet you." Strange was leaning against the windowsill with his arms crossed, looking intently at her. She, on the other hand, took as little notice of him as she had of Aunt Greysteel or Miss Greysteel, or any of her visitors of the last few days. She took as little notice of him as a cat takes of anybody who does not interest it. "Let me first assure you," said Strange, "that I am not one of those tiresome visitors who have no real purpose for their visit and nothing to say for themselves. I have a proposal to make to you, Mrs. Delgado. It is our excellent fortune, madam, that you and I should meet at this time. I am able to give you your heart's desire, and in return, you shall give me mine." Mrs. Delgado made no sign that she had heard any of this. She had turned her attention to the saucer with the dead mouse, and her ancient mouth gaped to devour it. "Really, madam," cried Strange, "I must insist that you put off your dinner for a moment and attend to what I'm saying." He leant forward and removed the saucer. For the first time, Mrs. Delgado seemed to know he was there. She made a little mew of displeasure and looked resentfully at him. "I want you to teach me how to be mad. The idea is so simple, I wonder I did not think of it before.
Mrs. Delgado growled very low.
Oh, you question the wisdom of my proceedings. You are probably right. To wish madness upon oneself is very rash. My tutor, my wife, and my friends would all be angry if they knew anything of it.
He paused. The sardonic expression disappeared from his face, and the light tone disappeared from his voice.
But I have cast off my tutor. My wife is dead, and I am separated from my friends by 20 miles of chill water and the best part of a continent. For the first time since I took up this odd profession, I am not obliged to consult anyone else. Now, how to begin? You must give me something, something to serve as a symbol and vessel of your madness.
He glanced around the room.
Unfortunately, you do not appear to possess anything except your gown.
He looked down at the saucer, which he held in his hand.
And this mouse. I believe I prefer the mouse.
Strange began to say a spell. There was a burst of silver lights in the room. It was something between white flames and the glittering effect which fireworks produce. For a moment, it hung in the air between Mrs. Delgado and Strange. Then Strange made a gesture as if he intended to throw it at her. The light flew towards her, and just for a moment she was bathed in a silver radiance. Suddenly, Mrs. Delgado was nowhere to be seen, and in her place was a solemn, sulky girl in an old-fashioned gown. Then the girl, too, disappeared, to be replaced by a beautiful young woman with a willful expression. She was followed swiftly by an older woman of imperious bearing, but with a glint of impending madness in her eyes. All the women Mrs. Delgado had ever been flickered for an instant in the chair. Then all of them disappeared. On the chair was only a heap of crumpled silk. Out of it stepped a little gray cat. The cat jumped daintily down, sprang up on the windowsill, and vanished into the darkness.
Well, that worked, said Strange.
He picked up the half-rotten dead mouse by its tail. Instantly, he became interesting to several of the cats who mewed and purred and rubbed themselves against his legs to attract his attention. He grimaced.
And what was John Usglass forced to endure, I wonder, in order to forge English magic?
He wondered if he would notice any difference.
Would he find, after he had done the spell, that he was trying to guess if he were mad now? Would he stand about trying to think mad thoughts to discover if any of them seemed more natural?
He took a last look around at the world, opened his mouth, and gingerly lowered the mouse into it. It was like plunging beneath a waterfall or having 2,000 trumpets sound in one's ear. Everything he thought before, everything he knew, everything he had been, was swept away in a great flood of confused emotion and sensation. The world was made again in flame-like colors that were impossible to bear. It was shot through with new fears, new desires, new hatreds. He was surrounded by great presences. Some had wicked mouths full of teeth and huge burning eyes. There was a thing like a horribly crippled spider that reared up beside him. It was full of malice. He had something in his mouth, and the taste of it was unspeakable. Unable to think, unable to know, he found from God knows where the presence of mind to spit it out. Someone screamed. He found that he was lying on his back, staring up into a confusion of darkness, roof beams, and moonlight. A shadowy face appeared and peered into his own face in an unnerving manner. Its breath was warm, damp, and malodorous. He had no recollection of lying down, but then he did not have much recollection of anything. He wondered vaguely if he were in London or Shropshire. There was the queerest sensation all over his body, as if several cats were walking on him at once. After a moment, he raised his head and found that this was indeed the case. He sat up, and the cats leapt away. The full moon shone down through a broken window. Then, mounting from recollection to recollection, he began to piece the evening together. He remembered the spell by which he had transformed the old woman, his plan to bring madness upon himself in order to see the fairy. At first it seemed to him so distant that he thought he must be remembering events that had happened, oh, perhaps a month or so ago. Yet here he was, in the room, and he found by his pocket watch that scarcely any time had passed at all. He managed to rescue the mouse. By luck, his arm had fallen upon it,
and kept it safe from the cats. He tucked it into his pocket and left the room hurriedly. He did not want to remain there a moment longer. The room had been nightmarish to begin with. Now it seemed to him a place of untold horror. He met several people on the stairs, but they took not a scrap of notice of him. He had previously cast a spell over the inhabitants of the house, and they were quite convinced that they saw him every day, that he frequented these rooms regularly, and nothing was more natural than that he should be there. But if anyone had asked them who he was, they would have been quite unable to say. He walked back to his lodgings at Santa Maria Zobenigo. The old woman's madness still seemed to infect him. People he passed in the street were strangely changed. Their expression seemed ferocious and unintelligible, and even their gait was lumbering and ugly. Well, one thing is clear, he thought. The old woman was very mad indeed. I could not possibly summon the fairy in that condition. The next day he rose early, and immediately after breakfast began the process of reducing the flesh and guts of the mouse to a powder, according to various well-known principles of magic. The bones he preserved intact. Then he turned the powder into a tincture. This had two advantages. First, and by no means least, it was considerably less repulsive to swallow a few drops of tincture than to put a dead mouse in his mouth. Secondly, he believed that in this way he might be able to regulate the degree of madness he imposed upon himself. By 5 o'clock, he had a darkish brown liquid, which smelt chiefly of the brandy he had used to make the tincture. He decanted it into a bottle. Then he carefully counted 14 drops into a glass of brandy and drank it. After a few minutes, he looked out of the window and into the Campo Santa Maria Zobenigo. People were walking up and down. The backs of their heads were hollowed out. Their faces were nothing but thin masks at the front. Within each hollow, a candle was burning. This was so plain to him now that he wondered he had never noticed it before. He imagined what would happen if he went down into the street and blew some of the candles out. It made him laugh to think of it. He laughed so much that he could no longer stand. His laughter echoed round and round the house. Some small remaining shred of reason warned him that he ought not to let the landlord and his family know what he was doing. So he went to bed and muffled the sound of his laughter in the pillows, kicking his legs from time to time with the sheer hilarity of the idea. Next morning he awoke in bed, fully dressed, and with his boots still on. Apart from the dull, greasy feeling that generally results from sleeping in one's clothes, he believed he was much as usual. He washed, shaved, and put on fresh clothes. Then he went out to take something to eat and drink. There was a little coffee house that he liked on the corner of the Calle de la Cortesia and the Campo San Angelo. All seemed well until the waiter approached his table and put the cup of coffee down upon it. Strange looked up and saw a glint in the man's eye like a tiny candle flame. He found he could no longer recall whether people had candles in their heads or not. He knew that there was a world of difference between these two notions. One was sane, and the other was not. But he could not for the life of him remember which was which. This was a little unsettling. The only problem with the tincture, he thought, is that it is really quite difficult to judge when the effects have worn off. I have not thought of that before. I suppose I ought to wait a day or two before trying it again. But at midday, his impatience got the better of him. He felt better. He was inclining to the view that people did not have candles in their heads. And anyway, he thought, it does not much matter which it is. The question has no relevance to my present undertaking. He put 9 drops of the tincture into a glass of vino santo and drank it down. Immediately, he became convinced that all the cupboards in the house were full of pineapples. He was certain that there were other pineapples under his bed and under the table. He was so alarmed by this thought that he felt hot and cold all over and was obliged to sit down on the floor. All the houses and palazzi in the city were full of pineapples, and outside in the streets people were carrying pineapples, hidden under their clothes. He could smell the pineapples everywhere, a smell both sweet and sharp. Sometime later, there was a knock at his door. He was surprised to find it was now evening and the room was quite dark. The knock sounded again. The landlord was at the door. The landlord began to talk, but Strange could not understand him.
and this was because the man had a pineapple in his mouth. How he had managed to cram the whole thing in there, Strange could not imagine. Green, spiky leaves emerged slowly out of his mouth, and then were sucked back in again as he spoke. Strange wondered if perhaps he ought to go and fetch a knife or a hook and try and fish the pineapple out, in case the landlord should choke. But at the same time, he did not care much about it. After all, he thought with some irritation, it is his own fault. He put it there. The next day in the coffee house on the corner of the Calle de la Cortesia, one of the waiters was cutting up a pineapple. Strange, huddled over his coffee, shuddered to see it. He had discovered that it was easier, far easier than anyone could have supposed, to make oneself mad. But like all magic, it was full of obstacles and frustrations. Even if he succeeded in summoning the fairy, which did not seem very likely, he would be in no condition to talk to him. Every book he had ever read on the subject urged magicians to be on their guard when dealing with fairies. Just when he needed all his wits, he would scarcely have any wits at all. How am I supposed to impress him with the superiority of my magicianship if all I can do is babble about pineapples and candles, he thought. He spent the day pacing up and down his room, breaking off every now and then to scribble notes upon bits of paper. When evening came, he wrote down a spell for summoning fairies and put it on the table. Then he put 4 drops of tincture into a glass of water and swallowed it. This time, the tincture affected him quite differently. He was not assailed by any peculiar beliefs or fears. Indeed, in many ways, he felt better than he had in a long time. Cooler, calmer, less troubled. He found that he no longer cared very much about magic. Doors slammed in his mind, and he went wandering off into rooms and hallways inside himself that he had not visited in years. For the first 10 minutes or so, he became the man he had been at 20 or 22. After that, he was someone else entirely, someone he had always had the power to be, but for various reasons had never actually become. His first desire, after taking the tincture, was to go to a ridotto. It seemed ridiculous that he should have been in Venice since the beginning of October and never visited one. But on examining his pocket watch, he discovered that it was only 8 o'clock. That is much too early, he remarked to no one in particular. He was feeling talkative and looked round for someone to confide in. For lack of anyone better, he settled upon the little wooden figure in the corner. There will be no one worth seeing for 3 or 4 hours yet, he told it. To fill the time, he thought he might go and find Miss Graysteel. But I suppose her aunt and father will be there. He made a small sound of irritation. Dull, dull, dull. Why do pretty women always have such herds of relatives? He looked at himself in a mirror. Dear God, this neckcloth looks as if it were tied by a ploughman. He spent the next 30 minutes tying and retying the neckcloth until he was satisfied with it. Then he discovered that his fingernails were longer than he liked and not particularly clean. He went to look for a pair of scissors to cut them with. The scissors were on the table, and something else besides. What have we here? He asked. Papers. Papers with magic spells on them. This struck him as highly amusing. You know, it is the queerest thing, he told the little wooden figure, but I know the fellow who wrote this. His name is Jonathan Strange, and now that I think about it, I think these books belong to him. He read a little further. You will never guess what idiocy he is engaged in now. Casting spells to summon fairies. He tells himself he is doing it to get himself a fairy servant and further the cause of English magic. But really, he's only doing it to terrify Gilbert Norrell. He has come hundreds of miles to the most luxurious city in the world, and all he cares about is what some old man in London thinks. How ridiculous. He put the piece of paper down again in disgust and picked up the scissors. He turned and just avoided striking his head against something. What in the world? He began. A black ribbon hung from the ceiling. At the end of it were a few tiny bones, a phial of some dark liquid, blood perhaps, and a piece of paper with writing on it, all tied up together. The length of the ribbon was such that a person moving about the room was almost certain to knock against it sooner or later. Strange shook his head in disbelief at other people's stupidity. Leaning against the table, he began to cut his nails. Several minutes passed.
He had a wife, you know,
he remarked to the little wooden figure. He brought his hand near to the candlelight to examine his nails.
Arabella Woodhope, the most charming girl in all the world. But dead, 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 dead.
He picked up a nail buffer from the table and began to polish his nails with it.
In fact, now that I come to think of it, was I not in love with her myself? I think I must have been. She had the sweetest way of saying my name and smiling at the same time, and every time she did so, my heart turned over.
He laughed.
You know, it really is very ridiculous, but I cannot actually remember what my name is.
Lawrence?
Arthur. Frank? I wish Arabella were here. She would know. And she would tell me, too. She is not one of those women who tease one and insist upon making a game of everything long after it has ceased to be amusing. By God, I wish she were here. There's an ache here.
He tapped his heart.
And something hot and hard inside here.
He tapped his forehead.
But half an hour's conversation with Arabella would put both right, I'm sure. Perhaps I ought to summon this fellow's fairy and ask him to bring her here. Fairies can summon the dead, can they not?
He picked up the spell from the table and read it again.
There's nothing to this. It is the simplest thing in the world.
He rattled off the words of the spell, and then, because it seemed important to do so, he went back to shining his nails. In the shadows, by the painted cupboard, there was a person in a leaf-green coat, a person with hair the color of thistledown, a person with an amused, superior sort of smile upon his face. Strange was still intent upon his nails. The gentleman with the thistledown hair walked very rapidly over to where Strange stood and put out his hand to pull Strange's hair. But before he could do so, Strange looked directly at him and said,
I don't suppose you happen to have such a thing as a pinch of snuff, do you?
The gentleman with the thistledown hair froze.
I've looked in every pocket of this damn coat, continued Strange, perfectly unaware of the gentleman's astonishment. But there's not a snuff box anywhere. I cannot imagine what I was thinking of to come out without one. Kendall Brown is what I generally take, if you have it.
As he spoke, he fished in his pockets again. But he had forgotten about the little bone and blood posy that hung from the ceiling, and as he moved, he knocked his head against it. The posy swung back, swung forward again, and struck him fairly in the middle of his forehead. Chapter 54. A Little Box, the Color of Heartache. 1st and 2nd of December, 1816. There was a kind of snap in the air, followed immediately by a faint breeze and a new freshness, as if some stale odor had suddenly been swept from the room. Strange blinked two or three times. His first thought upon coming to himself was that his whole elaborate scheme had worked. Here was someone, without doubt a fairy, standing before him. His second thought was to wonder what in the world he'd been doing. He pulled out his pocket watch and examined it. Almost an hour had passed since he'd drunk the tincture.
I beg your pardon, he said. I know it is an odd question, but have I asked anything of you yet?
Snuff, said the gentleman with the thistledown hair.
Snuff? You asked me for a pinch of snuff.
When?
What?
When did I ask you for snuff?
A moment ago.
Good. Well, you need not trouble yourself. I do not need it now. The gentleman with the thistledown hair bowed. Strange was conscious that his confusion showed in his face. He remembered all the stern warnings he had read against letting members of this tricksy race suspect that they know more than oneself. So he covered up his perplexity with sarcastic looks, then remembering that it is generally considered even more perilous to appear superior and so make the fairy spirit angry, he covered up his sarcasm with a smile. Finally, he went back to looking puzzled. He did not notice that the gentleman was at least as uncomfortable as himself.
I have summoned you here, he said, because I have long desired one of your race to aid me and instruct me in magic.
He had rehearsed this little pronouncement several times, and was pleased to find that it sounded both confident and dignified. Unfortunately, he immediately spoilt the effect by adding anxiously, "Did I mention that before?" The gentleman said nothing. "My name is Jonathan Strange. Perhaps you have heard of me. I am at a most interesting point in my career. I believe it is no exaggeration to say that the entire future of English magic depends upon my actions in the coming months. Agree to help me, and your name will be as famous as those of Col Tom Blue and Master Wycherley." Footnote 1. Col Tom Blue was, of course, the most famous servant of Ralph Stokesy. Master Wycherley assisted Martin Pale. "Tut," declared the gentleman in disgust. "Low persons." "Really?" said Strange. "I had no idea." He pressed on. "It was your..." He paused to find the right phrase. "Kind attentions to the King of England that first brought you to my notice. Such power, such inventiveness. The English magic today lacks spirit, it lacks fire and energy. I cannot tell you how bored I am of the same dull spells to solve the same dull problems. The glimpse I had of your magic proved to me that it is quite different. You could surprise me, and I long to be surprised." The gentleman raised one perfect fairy eyebrow, as if he would not object in the least to surprising Jonathan Strange. Strange continued excitedly. "Oh, and I may as well tell you immediately that there is an old person in London called Norrell, a magician of sorts, who will be driven into fits of rage the moment he learns that you have allied yourself to me. He will do his best to thwart us, but I dare say you and I will be more than a match for him."